Okay, we're starting here on the bottom of Dalet Amud Bet. Tanur Banan, Dinei Mimonot Bishlosha. As we've seen until now, Dinei Mimonot are carried out with three judges. But now we have a new din, which is Vimaya Mumchel Rabim. This person was an expert to the public at large. Dan Afilu Yechidi. And that individual can adjudicate these cases even as an individual. And now we have examples of that. Amar Rav Nachman, Kavon Ana, Dan Dinei Mimonot Bichidi. Rav Nachman says about himself, someone like myself could adjudicate a case or a monetary matter alone. That doesn't mean that he actually did it. He's just saying that he was qualified to do it. Whether he actually did it or not, it's not clear here from the Gemara. Also myself, Rabbi Chia says, I am qualified to adjudicate these monetary matters alone. And now the Gemara will go on to question this somewhat. Here we have a number of items that we need to clarify. The first of which is Dan Yechidi, the ability to adjudicate a case alone. We know the Mishnah in Avot says, Altihi Dan Yechidi, Ela Echad, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The only one that is supposed to be Dan Yechidi is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So how can over here, all of a sudden we have this ability from one judge to adjudicate a case, when the Mishnah of Avot speaks strongly against adjudicating cases alone, because the only one who really has that status or that power is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Balei Tosafot give one answer, which is Eitza Tova Kemach Malan Shelo Yite. It's good advice. It's not normative. That Mishnah in Avot is just giving you advice. It's better not to do it alone, so you don't make mistakes. But that there's no normative restriction against being done Yechidi. And he goes on to say V'had Amar Kugonano. So then, what about these Amoraim who basically did this or said that we did it? Rav Nachman, Rabbi Chia, Hainu Kloma Yecholadun. That's what I just noted for you, which is that they had the ability to do it, but that doesn't necessarily mean they actually did it. Inami ragil haya bedinim vein lachush shemite, or because they were so well versed in these matters that they weren't worried about making a mistake. And that might be the definition of mumchel rabim. Mumchel rabim is someone who's been tried and tested sufficiently that they're already considered to be an expert. They've seen enough cases, they have enough experience by which they're not going to make these types of mistakes, or they're certain about their ability to judge, even with the others there. Now, the truth is that it might actually be a derivative of the case of a Dinei Mimonot B'Shlosha. The way that we had explained it on the Mishnah, Dinei Mimonot B'Shlosha, is that you have one judge who takes the side of one party, another judge who takes the side of the other party, and then you have a Machria. In the end, it's really one judge, if we're dealing with the case of majority, that sways the case or has the outcome be determined by one judge. So even in the case of three, it's still one judge that pivots the case in any direction. So here, if we have a Yachid Mumche, it's not so far-fetched to say that that individual could adjudicate the case alone. Now, what is the source for this? Rashi makes the claim over here, and he's referencing back to the Gemara on Gimel Amud Aleph, where we did see an opinion like this, that there's an opinion there that a judge for these matters or monetary matters of Hodot HaVaot is Mido Oraita, only requires one judge. And that's because Ein Eruv Parshiot Kan, which is Rashi says over here, that person believes that there is no Eruv Parshiot, meaning that the Parshia of Hodot HaVaot isn't just placed in the middle of Shomer Chinam, and that cross-referencing of the two would allow you to say that the word Elohim, which appears three times there, which requires a baked-in minimum of three and of mumchim, if you have Eruv Parshiot, that would be true by Shomrim as well as Hodot Valvot. And according to this, in Eruv Parshiot and Hodot Valvot have no source for the fact that there are three judges and no source for the fact that there is a need for mumchim. And the only source you have is Bitzedek Tishpot Amitecha. That's the pasuk that Rashi quotes over here. And that is written in the singular, Tishpot, that an individual can adjudicate. How you know he has to be a mumche, according to this, according to Rashi, is because if you want it to be Bitzedek, if you want it to be a just outcome, you need an expert to do it. And so therefore, the source would be Midoraita, that Tzedek Tishpot et Amitecha, and the person here believes, or this Braita believes, that Ein Eruv Parshiot. That's the way Rashi learns it, and Rashi is therefore equating it to what we saw earlier in the Gemara on Daf Gimel Amud Aleph, the opinion that says that Yachid Midoraita is what you need by cases of Odot and Halvaot. The Balei Tosafot takes issue with the Rashi over here. He says, Vod Kashi, the Mashma Perisha Kuntus, the Mandi Itle Eruv Parshiot, Ein Yachol Adun Yachidi, because the problem is that, according to Rashi, The implications of his statement are that if you were to believe that there was Eruv Parshiot, that the Hodot V'Havot, or the Psukim that are found by Shomer Chinam that say, Asher Yomar Ki Huzeh Ad Elohim Yavod Dvar Shnehem, it's referencing to Modeh V'Mikzad by a Milveh, that means that you have overlap between Milveh or Hodot V'Havot and Shomrim, or Gzelot and Chavalot, that would mean that there is a requirement midoraita for three and for mumchim. So according to Rashi, that cannot be squared with the position of the braita that yachid mumchad rabim is done. And Tosfot says that doesn't make so much sense because he goes on to show that we have people who have the opinion that there is a eruv parshiot, and yet they still subscribe to this position of a yachid mumcheh. In addition, the Gemara should have also brought this braita as a question on the position of Rabbi Obo, who believes that you must have three individuals when it comes to adjudication. This seems to go against that position of Rabbi Obo. So why doesn't the Gemara bring this Braita as a disproof to his position? It must be that this Braita is not against that position of Rabbi Obo. And then the subsequent questions of the Gemara here also have to be in the position of Rabbi Obo, because according to Shmuel, we're going to see later in today's daf, who says that Shnaim Shadanu Dinahem Din, that two individuals adjudicate a case, their din is a din, they're just called a Beit Din Chatzuf. As the Balei Tosfot pointed out over there, that's even if one person does it. And there we're speaking about people who are not mumchim. So Shmuel's matir allows individuals who are not mumchim to do this. So obviously the Gemara in the discussion here is speaking within the context of Rabbi Obo, who normally requires three. So how do we reconcile that, or how do we do that if Rashi says the whole din here is a din d'oraita? And that means that you have two dinim d'oraita that are contradicted to each other. The Gemara over here was saying one, and Rabbi Obo was saying three. And he then says, even according to one who says that midoraita min haTorah, you require three mumchim, takanto derabonan hi. There's a takana derabanan that allows the yachid mumche derabim dan afil yuchidi. That a yachid mumche derabim has the right to adjudicate alone. So that Tosafot says that he thinks that this position here is irrespective of what you think of Eruv Parshiot. The din derabanan, at least, that indicates that you have a right to adjudicate a case when you have a yachid mumche, and maybe even a din d'oraita if you equate it to the case before. And therefore, this din has a broader application and is differentiated from the din on Gimel Aleph that talks about this being a d'oraita din from Tet Tzedek Tishpot et Amitecha, but rather is a din that is particular to Hodot V'Havot, that says a yachid mumche derabim has a right to adjudicate at least midrabanan. The last thing to discuss over here is what type of mumche are we speaking about. We have said until now that there was a requirement of a mumchim when it comes to a beit din, which is that you require smicha. Over here we have both Rav Nachman and Rabbi Chiya saying, oh, we are mumchim, or we're considered to be a mumche derabim. So is that the standard for mumchim over here now, Rav Nachman and Rabbi Chiya? That's a very high standard in terms of mumchim. And therefore, the Balei Tosafot over here say that it's different. Aval, yachid lo chashiv mumche rabim ad gamir v'savir. That the yachid mumche rabim is a much higher standard, and that's the standard that's being proffered over here, that's Rav Nachman and Rabbi Chiya. When you're talking about a beit din of shalosha, if you're talking about a beit din that incorporates three judges, then to be a mumche, you simply need to be a regular individual, or someone who has smicha, if you require mumchim over there, but not of the standard or the level that we're speaking about here, which is Rabbi Chiya and Rav Nachman. The last thing to note over here is that Tosfot says over here, dan afilu yachidi, the right to adjudicate matters as an individual, v'yachol lakofet adam bal korcho, that this judge has a right to compel the individual to do what he says, meaning that he can enforce this judgment. Because we're talking about here where the litigants accepted this person as an arbitrator or a judge over them, then you don't even need a mumche. As long as arbitration can be carried out by any individuals, once you've accepted whoever the judges are, then the litigants are bound by that acceptance, nothing to do with whether they're a mumche or not a mumche. And therefore, mikan, destam gimel, that's what it says over here, any three people that get together and form a beit din yocholim do donet adam bal kocho. They can adjudicate a case even against the will of the individual. Kasheinu rotzeh lavo de beit din. If he refuses to show up in beit din, if he refuses to respond to a subpoena or to the sheriff, then any three people can set up a beit din and then adjudicate the case and compel the individual to abide by their ruling. So then, what's the case later? Third parak later on. that each individual, each of the litigants gets a choice to pick their own Dayan, and then those two Dayanim pick a third Dayan amongst them, makes it sound like the individual, the litigants, have a right to decide who the Beit Din is, and the Beit Din cannot be imposed upon them. So how do you square that with what we're saying over here, that a Yachid Mumche can't force the individual to listen to him against his will? And Tosafot also just said three who get together to form a Beit Din also can compel the individual to abide by their judgment. So Tosafot makes a distinction over here, which is important, which is that Hani Mili Kishemir Lo Adon Lifneze Elifneze. If the individual says, I don't want to go to the court that you're picking, or I don't want to have this person adjudicate the case, but rather I'd like so-and-so, or I'd be okay with so-and-so, in those instances we respond favorably to his request and say that, okay, he has a right to object to the Beit Din as long as he's willing to show up at Beit Din, as long as we can come to a agreement about who the Beit Din is. On the other hand, in a situation where Aval Emamar Shalo Yavo Klal Beit Din, in a case where he is in contempt of court and refuses to show up whatsoever, then, oh, im ha'ya lo veh, v'enu etzila don klal bi'iro, or he's a debtor and he doesn't want to be judged in this city or the city of the Malveh at all, kofino to v'dan yoto b'alkochol, we compel him to accept the judgment that is being brought over here, whether that's the dan of yechid mumcheh, or even by shlosha b'nei adam, they are empowered to adjudicate the case and compel him to listen, if he refuses to show up in court and he refuses to abide by the request of the court to come. But if he just says, I don't like this particular court, but I'm willing to deal with another court, or we can appoint a court, in that case, we do listen to him and we give him the opportunity to change over the case and do not compel him to listen to the din against his will. We do not ignore his requests over here. Now the Gemara says, Ibailuhu, when Rav Nachman and Rav Chia offer themselves up as an example of an individual who is a Yachid Mumcheh Rabim, is that Kagon Ana, the Gamirna, the Savirna? Is it like us, or like myself, that both learnt and is able to extrapolate? Meaning Gamirna is wisdom, the ability to understand and to know the halachot, and then Savirna is your Habina, which is the ability to take the wisdom that you have and extrapolate it and expand it to other areas. So the requirement that you be like Rav Nachman or Rav Chia to be considered Mumcheh Rabim is that standard, Gamirna v'Savirna, Unikitna Rishuta, and you have permission from the Reish Galuta to be a Dayan or to adjudicate cases. Avalonokit Rishuta Dine La Dina. If there's a case where he does not have permission from the Reish Galuta, then his adjudications would be vacated because he doesn't have permission to be a judge. Odilma, or maybe what they're saying is, Afagadlo Nakit Rishuta Dina Edina. Even if he doesn't have permission, since he was Garmirna of the Savirna, he's clearly qualified. The only thing he didn't do was get permission in order to be a Dayan. In that case, we will say that even if he doesn't have permission, his din is still a fair din and a proper din, and therefore we won't vacate his decision, or his decisions would be binding. As Tosafot points out, this question is really within the position of Rabbi Ubo, who normally requires three. Then, in this instance where the Chachamim allowed one to do this, does he require permission, ordination to be conferred upon him by the Reish Galuta or not? Because according to Shmuel, you don't even need ordination. As we're going to see at the second half of today's daf, even a single individual has a right, bidyavad, to adjudicate a case. So Tashma, the Marzutra Breder of Nachman, Dan Dina Vita'a. This situation, Marzutra Breder of Nachman went ahead and adjudicated a case and made a mistake. After the Kamei Rav Yosef, so he came before Rav Yosef to figure out what to do. Amar Leis, so Rav Yosef says back to him, Im Kibluch Alayhu Lo Tishalem. If they accepted you as an arbitrator, then you don't have to pay, because the acceptance of you of an arbitrator is whether you come to the right conclusion or whether you come to the wrong conclusion. Irrespective, they are going to accept, or they're willing to accept, your decision. Vilo, if that's not the case, zil shlim, then you gotta go and pay. So Rashi says something interesting over here, which is, im kabluch alayhu, the gamre, lelech acharecha, if they fully accepted whatever you said, no matter what it is, im ledin, im letot, whether you get the right law or the just outcome, or whether you make a mistake, lo itva'ucha, lo tishalim, and they're not going to make any claims, or you have gained immunity from them because of that, then you don't have to pay. Vilo zil shlim. If they did not accept your mistakes because they asked you to be dan din Torah, they said come to the right outcome, the outcome that the Torah would prescribe in this case, If you didn't come to that conclusion, then you got to pay in this instance. Now you can see in the Balei Tosafot, who, when Rashi says over here, V'lo zil shlim perish b'kuntris, could go and damar leh dayan lan din Torah. If they said to him, we want you to conclude whatever the Torah would say. V'kasha dim kein my diek mehocha da filo lo gamir v'savir nami. What's the diok from over here? Because even in a case where he wasn't gamir v'savir, whatever is done is done. V'shalem b'beito. And therefore he would have to pay out of his house. If they accepted it, him, to give the din Torah, then what does it matter what his status is, or whether he's a yachid mumcheh de rabim or not? So lekach nira, dim lo kibuch alayu klal. So as opposed to what Rashi says, that one way means we accept your decision, irrespective of whether it comes out the right way, or the just, or the Torah way, or if it's a mistake. The other possibility is we just accept you to give us a din Torah. Why does Tosafot say, once you do that, then you can have anybody here. You don't need a mumcheh de rabim in that situation. Therefore, Balei Tosafot say that the negative statement is, im lo kibuch klal, they didn't accept you at all, meaning that they didn't accept you as an arbitrator to do whatever you want, irrespective of what the right outcome was, and neither did they accept you as a dan din Torah. They simply didn't accept you. They came before you to act as a judge, but they didn't make any statements of acceptance. So that's what Tosafot says the situation is over here. So now, shma mina. From this you would conclude, that even if you do not have permission from the Reish Galuta, nevertheless, the decision that you rendered is binding. Because over here, Marzucha Breder of Nachman, who did not have permission to Paskin, or did not have permission for the Reish Galuta, and then now when he made a mistake, Rabbi Yosef is saying to him, go pay for that mistake, because it's your fault and you're responsible for it. We're not granting you immunity. What you see from that is that, even though he's not granted immunity because he didn't get reshut, nevertheless, his decision stands. And since his decision is binding, that's why he's got to pay compensation to the individual he hurt by making that mistake. In other hand, if you believe that his decision was completely vacated, then there's no reason to pay for the mistake because the decision wasn't binding. We're going to undo the decision, and so why should you have to pay for the mistake? The decision's not going to stand. It's not binding. It's going to be vacated. So what you see from here is that the decision is binding. And since the decision is binding, that's why he's got to pay up now. That's why he's got to pay for the mistake that he made. I'm a Rav. I'm on the boy that made the dina. If a person wants to be a judge and adjudicate cases and preside over cases, vitami boy the miftara. And if he makes a mistake, he'll still be patur. He'll be exonerated. Lishko reshuta mi bei resh galuta. Get permission from the exilarch. If you get permission from the exilarch, then you're covered. You gain immunity as a judge in this situation. V'chein amar Shmuel, similar to what Rav says, Shmuel says the same thing. Lishko reshuta mi bei resh galuta. You need to get permission from the resh galuta. Now, later on, the Balei HaTosafot are going to explain that when it comes to a samuch, someone who has smicha, someone who's ordained, or is considered to be a mumcheh, it seems that if you are granted that right, you have the right now to pass it to others. You become empowered to bestow that ability or that smicha on the next person if you receive it. Over here, we speak about the right to paskin or get smicha derives from the resh galuta. So it seems that over time, there was a consolidation of the accreditation of the dayanim to the exilarch or to the resh galuta, even though before that, it seems that it was more free-flowing or free-form, which is that once you were ordained, or once you did receive smicha, you could then pass it to anybody you believed was worthy or deserving of you giving them smicha. But here we say that that power is now vested with the Reish Galuta, and if you don't get permission from the Reish Galuta, you'll be on the hook for mistakes that you make. And then if you get permission from the Reish Galuta, you're granted immunity. That's the reason to get the permission, is to gain that immunity, because now you're serving in the capacity under the official auspices of the Reish Galuta. This assumes that the Reish Galuta is going to act in an appropriate manner, and that he's bound by halacha. He's not going to abuse this power and qualify individuals who are unqualified. That he would only give smicha, or he would only ordain people who were deserving of that ordination. If the Reish Galuta is a religious figure, and is someone who is a leader in the community, then you could understand that. The Reish Galuta, we're going to see in a second, is a very strong political position, and so then if it comes a situation in which that political position, in a sense, causes it to supersede the halachic knowledge or religious standing of the Reish Galuta, then you might start running into a problem where you have unqualified individuals, at least religiously, who are the Reish Galuta and therefore are empowered to give Rishut. So the assumption here is that the Reish Galuta will act in a proper manner and that he will abide by the laws. But it seems in general that the Exilarch was a person of erudition, or he would have advisors or consultants of Talmidei Chachamim that would advise him in religious matters and would be a part of the quote-unquote house of the Exilarch or the administration of the Exilarch to ensure that there was proper administration and conferring of the smicha to parties that needed it or should have it. So it's right. You don't need the permission of the Reish Galuta to be a dayan. You're just not going to gain that immunity that is afforded by the Reish Galuta's permission. So when it says, pshita mihocha lahocha, umihotam lahotam, umihocha lahotam. So when the Bavli speaks about mihocha, hocha means here in Bavel, hota means over there in Eretz Yisrael. So it's clear if you got permission from the Reish Galuta in order to be a dayan, that permission is sufficient for you to do this anywhere in Bavel. So no matter where you move around in Bavel, you will still have that empowerment. If you're in Eretz Yisrael, and you gain that right from the Nasi in Eretz Yisrael, then within Eretz Yisrael, you have free reign to judge or adjudicate in any case, because you've been granting permission, and anything that's under the auspices of the Nasi, or the religious council in Eretz Yisrael, then you have rights in those areas to Paskin, and that's all of those areas, not just in the locale where you got the smicha. Similarly, if you go from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, your ordination in Bavel will be able to be used in Eretz Yisrael. Mahani. In all these cases, it works. The halcha shevet, v'hotam michokek. Because over here, it is like the shevet, which is the staff, or the stick of the leader that he uses to put the people in line and to press the people into line. V'hotam michokek. And over there, it's a michokek. Kedetanya, we have a braita that says in the bracha, the Yehuda from Yaakov, lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda, elo roshe galiot shibabavel. Shirodim et Yisrael b'shevet. Will not lose a shevet from Yehuda. The shevet over here refers to the staff of leadership. That means that the leadership will never leave the shevet of Yehuda, who hit B'nai Yisrael or move into line B'nai Yisrael with the shevet, with the staff. U'michokek mi ben regalav, edu b'nei banav shel Hillel. These are the descendants of Hillel in Eretz Yisrael. Shem lamdim Torah b'rabim, that teach Torah publicly. So we know the story of Hillel when he came from Bavel and the B'nai B'Teira with the Nesim at the time. And because of his erudition and his ability to answer the questions, they eventually appoint him as the Nasi. And then after he is the Nasi, which essentially established a familial dynasty of Nesim in Eretz Yisrael from that family of Hillel. And so what the Gemara is pointing out here is that there's a difference between the authority in Bavel and the authority in Eretz Yisrael. That's being reinforced by this braita, that within Eretz Yisrael it's called a mechokek, and then in Bavel the leadership is called a shevet. And as Rashi notes over here, that a shevet is a lashon srara, lashon of power, of lording over, v'yesh reshut hafkir tehefker beit nefker. So in Bavel, they have that legal strength in order to disown you from your property and enact Hefter Beit Din Hefker. Shirodim et Ha'am, Rashi says, she'esh lam koach v'rshut meit malchei paras. And here Rashi keys in on what seemingly is the source for this difference is, then in Mechokek, Rashi translates, sra'a mu'etet. It's a small position of leadership, or it's a smaller power base that you hold. Which is that both in Bavel and in Eretz Yisrael, the Nasi and the Reish Galuta were autonomous. But in Bavel, not only was the Reish Galuta autonomous, he also was granted power or permission by the Persian government to run the affairs of the Jewish community. And that means without outside intervention, the Reish Galuta governed the affairs of the Jewish community and was empowered from the government, from Malchei Paras, to do as he pleases and to really run an autonomous legal system and enforcement system over the Jews. So here you see the tremendous power that was vested in the Reish Galuta, and the truth is that the Reish Galuta was even an official position within the Persian government. And so you got into government salary, and you were a pretty senior official in the Persian government. On the other hand, when it comes to Eretz Yisrael, even though there were periods of time, especially under the rule of the Chashmonaim, where the Nasi had autonomous authority in Eretz Yisrael, with the introduction of foreign powers into Eretz Yisrael, the Greeks, the Romans, that diminished the power of the Nasi. But interestingly enough, it actually strengthened the position, even though it was politically detached. And that is because the Jews saw the Nasi as being a position that was independently appointed and was away from the political machinations of Rome. So in most positions, even religious positions in Eretz Yisrael, were governed by the Roman government or authorities. On the other hand, here you have something that was independent, and the Jews, in a sense, gravitated towards this Nasiut, investing the Nasi with power, because they saw that as being their ticket to autonomy, or their ability to influence the leadership and to take it away from Rome. And that comes to fruition in the Merit HaGadol by the Churban Beit HaMikdash, and then again in Merit Bar Kokhba, where the Nasi, in a sense, backs Bar Kokhba, and the Nasi also backs the Merit by the time of the Churban HaBayit. So in those situations, you see that the Nasi has a certain amount of power over the Jewish community, but again, that power is not vested in him by the Roman authorities or the governments that are present there. So that leads to a difference in terms of the empowerment or the strength of those in Bavel versus those in Eretz Yisrael. And given the strength or the power of the Reish Galuta, if he gives permission to someone, that permission goes from Bavel and is still valid in Eretz Yisrael. But vice versa, when someone has the permissions deriving from Eretz Yisrael, those permissions are not strong enough to be used in Bavel, or in essence, the authority of Bavel will preclude you from using your permissions from Eretz Yisrael in Bavel. Now, how to explain the difference between Shevet and Mechokek? Rashi explained over here, it had to do with the government authority vested in these individuals. On the other hand, the Bali Tosafot quote over here, a difference that the Rabbeinu Tam said that the Yerushalmi brings, that the difference is, Behind Utaimo Mishom de Rosh Kola Mizcharim Vinasish Veritz Israel Minikevot. The pasuk that they're quoting over here is from the Bracha of Yehuda, implying that the rulership or power of the Nasi and the Reish Galuta are a continuation of what we would otherwise know as Malchei Beit Yehuda, the kings or leadership that derives from Yehuda. So both the Nasi and the Reish Galuta were viewed as being, in a sense, the kings or coming from that authority of the familial lineage of David HaMelech. But as Yerushalmi points out, that's not completely true, which is because the Nasi in Eretz Yisrael was actually not a descendant of David HaMelech, but rather a descendant from the Nikevot, which means that one of David's daughters was the lineage that led to the Nasiim in Eretz Yisrael, where it was some male lineage that led to the Reish Galuta. And therefore, the difference in power vested here is how miyuchas are they. The Reish Galuta in Bavel has much stronger yichus or connection to Shevet Yehudah because that comes through the Zicharim, through the male, through a son of David. On the other hand, the Nesim and Eretz Yisrael, even though they're descendants of David, they come through a daughter of David HaMelech, and therefore they don't have that strength or the equivalent power to their counterparts in Bavel. That's the difference being explained here between Shevet and Mechokek. Now, the problem is that we find in other places like the Gemara and Psachim that it's just the opposite. That in Eretz Yisrael we give more power or authority to Eretz Yisrael versus Bavel. We have a similar concept in the beginning of Masechet Gittin, if you remember, with regards to whether when you have to say B'fanai Nechtav B'fanai Nechtam, over there the question was, from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, what was the status? And that machloket really deals with, or is similar in issue to what we're discussing over here, which is whether the power in Bavel was greater than the power in Eretz Yisrael, or vice versa. And here the Bali Tosfot point out that the Gemara in Pesachim seems to say the exact opposite of what we say over here. And then Varmei Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbeinu Tam reconciles those two by saying the following. When it comes to Iser Veheter, Bnei Eretz Yisrael are ascendant, or they have more authority. The Bnei Eretz Yisrael Chakimei Tfei, the people of Eretz Yisrael are wiser. and have more insight. Avira de Eretz Yisrael machkim, because the mere air quality in Eretz Yisrael brings out the wisdom and helps the person in their Torah learning. So that, in terms of Isser v'Hefter, Eretz Yisrael's got a leg up on Bavel. But when it comes to Afkat Mamon, when it comes to monetary matters, and the ability to extract money from litigants, be poter individuals and move money around because Hefker baked in Hefker, that power is a defi b'nei Bavel. That's better in Bavel. That's what the Rabbeinu Tam notes over here, that there's a difference in which area of halacha or which area of leadership you're speaking about. In some areas, Eretz Yisrael is ascendant or considered to be the primary location. That's by Yisra Hefter and issues of wisdom. When it comes to issues of monetary matters and enforcement, there Bavel has a stronger standing. And you can see that in the difference in the language that's used, which is that the Reish Galuta is called a Shevet, someone who uses the staff and beats the people to bring them into line, whereas the Nasi in Eretz Yisrael is called a Mechokech Shemalamei Torah Birabim, that their real empowerment was their Torah erudition and their ability to teach the Torah. That's basically their weapon in Eretz Yisrael, or their strength derives from their teaching of Torah, whereas in Bavel, their strength derives from the Shevet, from their ability to basically bring the people into line and the authority that is vested in them to do that. All right, so that all has to do with movement from within Bavel, movement within Eretz Yisrael, and then movement from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael. The question is, Mihotam Lahocha Mai, if you are ordained and got permission in Eretz Yisrael, and then came to Bavel, what's the din? Tashma, Derabba Bar Chano, Dan Dina V'ta'a. Rabbi Bar Chana, adjudicating a case, he made a mistake and came to the wrong conclusion. After the Kamei de Rabbi Chia, he went before Rabbi Chia, his uncle in Eretz Yisrael. Amalei, Ikiblu Chalaihu, if they accepted you as basically arbitrators or judges in the case, Lo Tishalom, don't pay. Because then you are granted immunity by the fact that they accepted you. Milo, if they did not accept you as arbitrators, Zil Shlim, then you gotta go pay because you made a mistake. Va Rabba Bar Chana, Deshuta Havanokit. Wait a minute. Rabba Bar Chana's permission, ordination, came from Eretz Yisrael. We're gonna see that story in a second. Shmamina. So what you see from here is Mihatam Laocha Lo Mahani. That going from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel does not provide you the immunity that you would have had in Eretz Yisrael. And what you see from this is that the protection afforded by that reshut, which usually would give you immunity, is not there when he went from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, or basically he's not covered by that immunity. But it says, V'lo mahani, is it really true now that you're telling us that if you've got smicha or ordination or permission to adjudicate in Eretz Yisrael, it's not sufficient in Bavel? Va Rabba bar Rav Huna. So Rabba bar Rav Huna says, Ki hava mintzei behadei bei Reish Galuta. When I was having an altercation with the Reish Galuta, meaning that they were at odds or at a difference of opinion, Amar lav minaychu nakit nareshuta. He says, my permission to adjudicate, my permission to be done, is not from you. Nakit nareshuta mi'abba mari. But rather, I got permission from my father. Here it's Rabba bar Rav Huna. So Rav Huna is his father. V'abba mari mi Rav. And my father Rav Huna got it from Rav, who is the Rebbe of Rav Huna. Rav me Rabbi Chia, and Rav got it from his Rabbi, Rabbi Chia. Rabbi Chia himself got it from Rabbi. And even though we're going to see in a second that that wasn't the case, and Rav got his smicha directly from Rabbi and not from Rabbi Chia, Balei Tosafot point out that someone with smicha can confer smicha ordination going forward. There might have been a technical problem, either that Rabbi was the Nasi, or he was the Rebbe of Rabbi Chia, and therefore Rabbi Chia either didn't feel it was appropriate, or was restricted from conferring that smicha while his Rebbe was still alive, or he was in the presence of his Rebbe, or that he wanted Rav to get it directly from Rabbi because it came with a cachet because he got it from Rabbi. But in essence, the Rebbe of Rav is Rabbi Chia, and that's why it's listed in this manner that there is this misora of smicha that comes all the way from Rabbi to Rabba bar Rav Huna. So here you have a clear delineation of the permission or ordination of Rabba bar Rav Huna coming from Eretz Yisrael, and he is saying to the Reish Galuta, the powers that are vested in me don't derive from you. So I am not forced to listen to what you are saying over here. Gemara says, Bemilta de Almahu de Ukim Lahu. He was fluffing his feathers. There was no real substance what he was saying. But he was just fluffing his feather and saying, I'm not under your auspices because I gained my permission from those in Eretz Yisrael. Nevertheless, it's not true. And he did have that right because of what we're seeing here in the Gemara, that if you travel from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, your ordination or your permission from Eretz Yisrael will not grant you immunity in Bavel. So now the Gemara says, V'chi ma'achar d'lo mehane. So now, if it doesn't work, Rabba Bar Chana reshuta noka lomali. Why did Rabba Bar Chana get ordained in Eretz Yisrael? He was leaving Eretz Yisrael to go to Bavel, so why did he bother to get ordination? Where it says, the Ayerot amdim ala gvulim. But the cities that sit on the border, it seems to be up in the northeast between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel. There is a large community, especially post the Churban, in the Golan, the Galil Elyon in the Golan. And that community from the Golan extends out to where the direction of Bavel is. And so there was some border areas between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel over there, where some of those cities followed or under the auspices of Eretz Yisrael. And they're close enough to Bavel that Rabba Bar Chana being in Bavel would be relevant to them. That's why he got permission. The Gemara asks, my reshuta. This permission that we're speaking about here, what exactly is this permission, or the term that I'm using for it is ordination. Now this reshuta, which we're going to say in a second, is the ordination, or the conferring of ordination, is the concept of smicha, which is something that confers the ability or the permissions to paskin in areas and grant you immunity if you make a mistake. The lineage of that is something that comes directly from Moshe Rabbeinu, is passed from person to person each generation until the point that we're speaking about currently. At some point, the persecutions of the Romans, we're going to see that later on in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, causes huge issues with the passing of the smicha, and that Mesorah is lost, and therefore we no longer have this concept of smicha, which is the passing directly of this Mesorah from person to person, which can go back to Moshe Rabbeinu, but rather we have something that is a semblance of that, what we call smicha today. Rabbi Bar Chana the Bavel. Rabbi Bar Chana was going on Yerida to Bavel. Amar le Rabbi Chia the Rabbi. So Rabbi Chia approaches Rabbi, who's the God of the door at the time, and is also the Nasi. Ben Achi Yerida the Bavel. My nephew, the son of my brother, is going on Yerida to Bavel. Please give smicha or reshut or permission to my nephew before he leaves Eretz Yisrael in order that he has ordination before he goes to Bavel. The way that it works here, and this is something that in the colloquial, we actually say it wrong today or incorrectly today, which is that when someone gets ordination in Isra Hefter, we call it Yore Yore. And in a case where he gets ordination in monetary matters, civil law, and the halachot of Choshen Mishpah, we call it Yodin Yodin. So that's the way it's said in the colloquial, the way that people pronounce it today, but that is a misquote from the Gemara that we're about to see. Because it's not Yore Yore, Yodin Yodin, but rather, the way to read the Gemara is the following. Yore, does he have permission to give hora'ah? Rabbi says, Yore, he can. So the first one is a question, and the second one is an answer. The first one is a question being posed to the Rebbe, saying, Yore, does this Talmid have the capacity or the ability to Yore to give hora'ah? And the Rabbi over here in this case, or the Rebbe, answers him, Yore, he does have such a right. Yodin, again it's a question. Does he have the ability to be dan dinei mimonot? Yodin. The answer is yes, he does have permission. Yatir bechorot, does he have a right to be matir bechorot, if you find a moment of bechor, because in their day where there was no longer a mikdash extant and they still had the din of bechor that they were practicing, those bechorot, or a main part of what a rav did was to look at bechorot to determine if they had a mum. Once they got a mum in them, they become like chulin. Yatir bechorot, does he have a right to look at the mumim on a bechor and be matir the bechor? Yatir. The answer is yes, he does have such permission. So here, Rabbi Chia is having Rabbi give ordination to his nephew, Rabba Bar Chana. In each of these cases, he's asking him what rights or what ordination is he giving him. Is he giving him Yore? The answer is yes, Yore. Is he giving him Yodin? Yes, Yodin. And then does he give him Yatir Bechorot? He says yes, he can be Matir Bechorot. Yavi Nochid Rab the Bavel. Similar story with regards to Rab. When he was going down to Bavel, doing Yerida to Bavel, Amalei Rabbi Chia the Rabbi, Ben Achuti Yore the Bavel. My nephew, through my sister, is going on Yerida to Bavel. Yore, does he have permission to give Hora'ah? Yore, Yodin, does he have permission to adjudicate monetary matters? Yodin, Yatir Bechorot, does he have a right to be Matir the Bechor? He says, Al Yatir. He says, no, he does not have permission to do it. So now, the Gemara is going to ask a couple questions about this story or these incidents. Maishna Lamar, the Kakari Le Ben Achi, why did Rabbi Chiya call Rabbi Bar Chana, his nephew, through his brother? What's the situation with regards to Rav, the Kariyeh Ben Achuti, that he called him, he's my nephew through my sister? What's the question? One of them is his nephew through his sister, and one of them is his nephew through his brother. Those are just the facts. It's nothing special. That's why, if you say that's the case, don't we have from the Gemara in Psachim that teaches us, Aibo, Vichana, Vishila, Umarto, Virabichia, Kulu bnei Abba bar Acha Karsula Mikafre Havu. They were all brothers. So some of these names you're going to recognize over here, which is the Chana, which is Rabba bar Chana. Here it sounds like the name Chana was used for a male, a brother, although there are those that suggest that Chana is really a woman's name, and that the Yichus of Rabba bar Chana comes from his mother because she was considered to be a Chashuva, and therefore they Miyaches him after her rather than his father. But in all likelihood, it seems that Chana was a brother to Rabbi Chiya, as well as Aibo is also a brother. So here, Chana, who's the father of Rabba bar Chana, Rabbi Chiya, and Aibo, who's the father of Rav, are all brothers. So you see that Rabbi Chiya is also an uncle to Rav through his father. So why do you make the distinction between Rabba bar Chana and Rav with regards to saying that he's my sister's son and not saying that they're both his brother's sons? Rav Barachua Dahava Barachate. Rav was his brother's son, who was also his sister's son. Rav Barachana Barachua Dahav Barachute. But on the other hand, Rav Barachano was his nephew through his brother, but that's it, but not through his sister at all. The answer that's being given here is fleshed down in the Gemara and Psachim and described in more detail there, which is that Rabbi Chiya's sister married Rabbi Chiya's brother, and those were the parents of Rav. That's Aibo and Ema. Aibo is Rav's father, and Ema is Rav's mother. Now, obviously, if they're brother and sister, they can't get married. So the truth is, they're not half-brothers and sisters, but rather step-brothers and sisters. And that is that Abba Bar Acha had a wife, or a first marriage, and produced out of that first marriage were all the names that we mentioned here, with the exception of Michia, were born out of that marriage. In addition, Abba Bar Acha married a second wife, and for that second wife, he had Rabbi Chiya. That second wife came into the marriage with a daughter from another man. That daughter's name was Ema. And so what you have here is a situation in which Rabbi Chiya is a half-brother to Ema, his sister, because they share a common mother. On the other hand, Rabbi Chiya and Aibo are brothers, half-brothers, because they share a common father. So Aibo is a brother through a common father. Ema is a sister through a common mother. But that means that Aibo and Ema have no familial relationship. They're not related at all, because they are just step-sister or step-brother, but there's no blood relationship between them. And that's why they could get married. They got married and had Rav. And that's why Rabbi Chiya can say, Rav is both my sister's son as well as my brother's son. But it's more unusual to be his sister's son, because that differentiated him from Rabbi Bar Chana. And that's why Rabbi Chiya over here called him Bar Achate and not Bar Achua. The other option here is not that he was saying something about the lineage or the relationship, familiar relationship over here, but rather Hashem Chachmato. It was after the wisdom of Rav, Dichtiv, and more the Chochmah, Achotiat. Say to Chochmah, you are my sister. So when he said he was Barachate, he was indicating that Rav was of tremendous erudition, or he was a real huge Talmud Chacham, even in excess of Rabba Bar Chana. So then the Gemara asks, Yatir Bechorot, when it came to Rab getting permission to be Matir Bechorot, Al Yatir, my time, what's the reason he didn't give him permission? If you say it's because he wasn't wise enough, he didn't have the right to it, Ha Kamrinan Dechokim Tuva. Didn't we just say that Rab was extremely wise and was very uniquely endowed in wisdom and erudition, which we said that emor lachukmah chotiat. So how can you claim that Rav wasn't of that sufficient stature or wisdom? Elamishum delo bikia bimumet, because he wasn't an expert in the blemishes of an animal. Those blemishes that are considered to be permanent and will allow you to be matir the bechor, versus those which are mumover, are passing problems in which we can't permit you then to shech the animal or keep the animal. Vama Rav, Shmonasar chodeshim gadalti etzel roeh beima. For 18 months, I lived out with the shepherds, by the shepherds. Leda ezimum kavua ezimum over. He basically apprenticed himself to the shepherds to learn about these matters. Ella the chalek lo kavod the Rabbi Bar Chana. The answer here is to why he gave permission for Rabbi Bar Chana to do yore, to do yodin, and to be matir b'chorot. But for Rabbi, only gave him permission for yore and yodin, but not yatir b'chorot. That was to give or to distinguish Rabbi Bar Chana in Bavel. As Rashi notes over here, that Rav was clearly more erudite and far in excess in terms of learning than Rabbi Bar Chana. He was also the superstar in Rabbi's shiur, and he was probably well known already in Bavel. And so when he got there, his stature would not be in question, or he would be received in a way or in a manner, proper status or stature that he had attained. Whereas Rabbi Bar Chana was a lesser known Talmid Chacham, and therefore Rabbi wanted to give him that additional smicha of Heter Bechorot in order for him to gain a foothold in Bavel and be able to establish himself even in the shadow of Rav. And so therefore Rabbi knew that Rav would gain acceptance immediately because of his stature, but it would take longer for Rabbi Bar Chana. So in order to facilitate that, he gave Rabbi Bar Chana that special aspect that he did not grant to Rav. By Dema, and some suggest Mishum Daha Gufa, the Rav, Kiyav Emunei Tvei, the real problem is that Rav was an extra super duper expert in being Matir B'chorot. Vishari Mume Delo Yade Inche. He was ended up being Matir Mumim that other people didn't understand or couldn't understand. V'amreki, I gavna shor Rav. And then they're going to say, oh, Rav was Matir this type of Mum. Batul the Mishrei Mum Over. And they're going to end up extrapolating it to matters or situations where it's not relevant or not true. And since Rav was so sharp and so good at this, Rabbi felt that it was too dangerous to allow him to be Matir B'chorot because of what would happen to the people who saw him be Matir such Mumim. What would they do, or how would they extrapolate it? Now the Gemara says, Yoreh, Yoreh, that we saw before, that we asked Rabbi if Rav, and same thing with Rabbi Bar Chana, where they had permission to give Psak Halacha with regards to Isur V'Heter, Yoredeya, and he said, Yoreh. In both instances, he gave them permission. The Gemara says, Igamir, if he knows the Halacha, and he learned the Halacha, and he's knowledgeable enough to give Psak Halacha, Reshuta Lamali the Mishkan. Why would you need permission or ordination in order to give Psak Halacha with regards to Isur V'Heter? We said before that the whole purpose of the Reshuta was to give immunity to the judge. So in issues of Choshen Mishpat and issues of civil suits and adjudication, I can understand a mistake there might have monetary implications, and you want to gain immunity from having to pay if you make a mistake over there. But by Isur V'Heter, why do you need immunity? We just need you to have the knowledge in order to Paskan Halacha. And we saw before in the previous Amud, that it doesn't, in order for you to give Psak Halacha, it doesn't mean that you need Reshut. Reshut is just a way to gain immunity. So what's the point of that? Now the truth is, as Bali Tosfo point out, that even by Isur V'Heter, you still would want immunity because there are times where there are monetary implications to the Psak Halacha with regards to Isur V'Heter. So Tosfo modifies the question slightly and says, if you already have permission by Yadin, by Choshen Mishpat, and you have immunity from that, that permission should also cover you by Isur V'Heter. And because then anything that happens that has monetary implications in essence becomes a Choshen Mishpat matter. And therefore, you would be covered by the immunity that you gained over there. If that's the case, then why do you need a separate permission by Isur V'Heter to give Psak Halacha? It should be based on whether you have the knowledge to give the Psak, not whether you have permission. It's because of an incident that took place. The Tanya, we have a bright, the Pamachad Alach Rabbi L'Makom Echad, Rabbi traveled to this location, V'ra'a B'nei Adam. And he saw that these people were kneading their dough, bitum'ah, means that they put water together with the flour, which is makshir, the item to be mekabel tum'ah, and the individuals themselves were also tumeim. And so therefore they were making the dough, bitum'ah. That has two implications. First of all, with regards to Eretz Yisrael, if the location is found in Eretz Yisrael, then we have a general principle that we try to minimize the amount of tum'ah in Eretz Yisrael, and Mermakbin in general, that even Chulin should be done Ayudei Tahara there. In addition, once you've made the dough, you have to be Mafrish Chala. Chala is the same din as Truma, and if it is dough that is Tmei'ah, then you get Chala Tmei'ah, which in essence is useless to the Kohen, is going to be burnt. If you do it B'Tahara, then the Chala that you Mafrish in that is Chala Tehora, and then the Kohen can use it, or utilize it, or eat it, And so therefore also you're going to cause a situation in which the challah is going to be useless because of the fact you're doing a bit too much. So Rabbi was surprised by the fact that they were doing this. Why is it that you don't worry about being mitame your isot, your dough over here? Why is it that you're not makpid on tuma? We had a Tamar Chochem that came through here. Vehorelanu, and he gave us instructions, he gave us a psakalocha, meibitzaim ein makshirim, that waters of the marsh are not makshir the kabel tuma. They do not prime the item to be mekabel tuma. One of the seven mashkim, yad shechad dam, those liquids are makshir, a solid or a food item to be mekabel tuma. And what they're suggesting over here is that this Tamar Chochem gave them a psakalocha that the waters of the marsh, if you use those waters instead of regular water, it would not be makshir the kabel tuma. And therefore, they didn't worry about doing it tuma because they didn't think they were conveying tuma to the isa. Behu may beitzim darash the hu. He didn't say to them may bitza. He didn't say to them the waters of the marsh, but rather the waters of the egg. And if you use the egg whites to knead the dough instead of water, then it's not makshir the kabel tuma because egg is not one of the liquids, quote unquote, that is makshir the kabel tuma that primes the item to be mekabel or to accept tuma. And so therefore, if you did it with eggs, it would have been fine. But they misinterpreted what he said about mei beitzim and thought he said mei bitzaim, that they thought it meant the marsh waters and not the mei beitzim, the egg whites. Although the Bali Tosfot think that that's far-fetched, that they would have mixed up words that were so different in nature. And therefore, the Rabbeinu Tam says that the word that they used was the same word beitzim, but the interpretation or the definition, the translation of the word beitzim is where the mistake was made. So it wasn't made a mistake in terms of the language, rather, the definition of beitzim. Does beitzim mean eggs, or does beitzim mean the waters of the marsh? So, v'inu savor, mei beitzim kamar. And they thought, he said, mei beitzim, the waters of the marsh. V'ta'u nami baha. In addition to that, their mistake was compounded by another Mishnah that we find by Paraduma, mei karmion, mei piga. These waters, these rivers that are marsh water rivers, psulim, ibnei shehein, mei beitzim. They are psulim. They are disqualified from being used for the waters of the Parah Duma because they are mei beitzim, or in essence, the way the Rabbeinu Tam is saying, mei beitzim over here means mei bitzaim. They're waters of the marsh, an extension of the waters that come from the marshes, these rivers that roll out from there. So they extrapolated this din by saying, well, if this water is disqualified for being used for the Parah Duma, binu savar negabe chatak psile, afshume nami lo machshirei. That means that they're not really considered to be water, and therefore they would also not prime the item or be makshirit the kabel tuma. Velohi, and they mistakenly made that extrapolation. Hatam lenin chatat. Over there, the reason it's disqualified by the parah duma is beinan mayim chayim. You need live spring water. But over there, these are not live spring water. These are marshes, or these are rivers that extend from the marsh. The Bali Tosafot note over here that we have in other places that these rivers were actually real rivers. And everybody says the disqualification of the river is not because it wasn't Maim Chaim, but the problem was that these were rivers that were heavily laden with silt and dirt in the water. It was very cloudy water. And therefore they were disqualified from being Maim Chaim because we require Maim Chaim El Keli. And you put the live spring water into the Kli. But over here, if you take this type of water that is so silty, that will cause it to have a hefsek between the water and the Kli. And that's why it's disqualified over here. But with regards to Heksha the Kabel Tuma, Hachakshure Koldehu Makshir. Here, any type of water, any type of liquid that is deemed to be water will be Makshir the Kabel Tuma, no matter how much silt is in it, no matter whether it is standing water or Mayim Chayim, all of these things would be Makshir the Kabel Tuma. So the standard for Heksha the Kabel Tuma is different than the standard by Paraduma. Because of those two mistakes, one was what they learned from this Talmud Chacham, they misinterpreted as Mei Beitzim, not to be referring to eggs, but rather to marsh waters. And their second mistaken assumption that the problem with Parah Duma from these rivers was the fact that they were not considered to be water. If they're not considered to be water, then also they would not be Makshir the Kabel Tuma. And again, that was a mistaken conclusion because they are water. They're just not water that's qualified to be good for the Parah Duma either because they're not Mayim Chaim. I mean, if they're Mayim Chaim, they're too silty, cloudy, and therefore you can't have Mayim Chaim El Keli. So because of that mistake, Tana Ba'oto Shah Gazru, at that moment, they put a decree in place, Tamid Al Yoreh Elim Gein Otel Rishut Mirabol, that a student may not go ahead and give Psak Halacha until he has given permission from his Rebbe or has been ordained by his Rebbe. Now, why does that solve the problem? Ordination just makes sure that you know the material. The problem here was not a question of knowledge. He gave them the right psak. The problem was the misinterpretation of the information that he gave or his lack of explanation or articulation about what the situation was. So if you look in Rashi, Rashi explains, when his Rebbe goes to ordain him and give him permission, he checks him out, that his language is articulate and clear, and their people won't misunderstand him. So there is a demand that you also have a course in homiletics before you actually are ordained as a rabbi. It's not enough to have the knowledge. It's not enough to have the intellectual capacity to be a rav. You need to also have the ability to communicate with the individuals who you are teaching in a clear and proper manner. If you lack the ability to communicate the knowledge that you have, then that ordination is inappropriate because your psak halacha is going to be misunderstood, maybe even misinterpreted, because you're not giving clear and direct messages to the people. And so part of the process of ordination then is to check that this individual is qualified not only from a knowledge standpoint, from a communication standpoint as well. Tamchum b'reit Rabbi Ami, ikla l'chatar. Tamchum went to this place called Chatar. Dorish lu, he was dorish with them, mutar l'utot chitin b'pesach. You're allowed to soak quickly the kernels of wheat on Pesach before you put them in the mill, even though we don't want any water coming into contact with it, but since here you're going to put it into the mill immediately, and it was only done to make it easier to mill the kernels, therefore the water will not cause a problem of chimutz over here, and therefore it's mutar l'utot tachitim b'pesach. Amru lo, lav Rabbi Mani demin sur ika hocha. Isn't Rabbi Mani but sur just next door over here? He's around here somewhere. And that was Tamkum Brei the Rabbi Ami's Rebbe. Betanya, and isn't there a breita? Talmid, ayure halacha b'mukom rabo. That a Talmud's not allowed to give psak halacha when his Rebbe is in town or local. Elaim kena yerachok mimenu shalosh parsot. Unless he has a minimum distance between him and his Rebbe of Shlosh Parsot, because it's considered then to be a different locale. And if you give psak over there, it's not an affront to your Rebbe. Whereas if you're in the locale of your Rebbe, it's appropriate, first of all, that you refer all cases to him. And number two is that you give deference to your Rebbe. And then if you have a question, you go ask him rather than paskening on your own. And the reason that Shlosh Parsot is considered to be a locale is because Keneged Machane Yisrael. That was the size of Machane Yisrael, which you have in the Gemara in a couple places, notes that when Bnei Yisrael were camping in Arvot Moav, it was from Beit HaYishimot ad Avel Shittim, and Rabbi Barachana says, I saw these two locations, and they're three parsot apart. So from that, we get the idea that the Machane Yisrael, the span of Machane Yisrael, was Shlosh Parsot. As Rashi notes over here, Moshe Rabbeinu was the Mora Hora'ah for Bnei Yisrael, and anybody who had a question for Moshe Rabbeinu used to go from anywhere in the Machane to Moshe Rabbeinu. So the truth is, if that is the case, then if Moshe sat in the middle of the Machane, then he wouldn't have the full three parsot. What you have to say is either this is the case when Moshe Rabbeinu took the tent or the Ol Moed out of the Machane, or it's a case where Moshe was found at one end of the Machane, and somebody on the other end of the Machane would still go to see Moshe on the other side of the Machane to get his psak halacha. That's what gives us this limit of sphere for the Rebbe, which is that three parsot is considered to be his sphere of influence. And within that area, the Talmid is inappropriate for him to give psak halacha. So how did Tamchum give psak halacha in this case? Amaloi says, back to Lama Badatai. He says, I didn't know that. I wasn't aware of the fact that my Rebbe is here. Had I known about it, I wouldn't have given a psak halacha. And not because I disagree with that halacha or because of any insolence that I would pass an halacha even when my Rebbe's around. Bali Tosafot over here points out that this seems to be in stira contradiction with the Gemara in Eruvin with regards to Piske halacha of Talmidim in the face of their Rebbe. Because over there in Eruvin, we first of all don't find this limitation of the three parsot, that if you're outside of three parsot, then you're okay. In addition, we also find in Eruvin that Talmidim refused to give psak halacha as long as their Rebbe was alive. And that we don't have this idea that if they were further away from their Rebbe, that they would have given the psak halacha. So Tosafot over here notes that there were those that tried to differentiate in a case between a Talmid and a Talmid Chaver. If a person's a Talmid, then he can't give psak halacha as long as his Rebbe's around or alive. Versus a case where he's a Talmid Chaver, then only within the sphere of influence, within the three parsot, is it inappropriate. But outside of that area, then it would have been appropriate. Ba'al Tosfa reject distinction because the source for this is Moshe Rabbeinu. And over by Moshe Rabbeinu, there's no such concept as a Talmud Chover to Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore, the din of three parsot, which is learned from Moshe Rabbeinu, must be speaking about not only a Talmud Chover, but even a regular Talmid. So Tosfa wants to know why over there is this no cutoff or limitation of three parsot. In the end, Tosfa says, V'nira dehatam mayri b'lo natal reshut mirabo. The case in Erevin was where he didn't have permission to give psak halacha. Therefore, since he didn't have permission to give psak halacha from his Rebbe, he can't paskin any time his Rebbe is still around or still alive. Nothing to do with the sphere of influence of the three parsot. In our case over here, he had permission to give psak halacha. That permission is only outside of the area of his Rebbe, outside of the three parsot. But inside the three parsot, then he would have to give deference to his Rebbe, and he would have to refer all cases to his Rebbe, or at least consult with his Rebbe with regards to all cases. And now the Gemara brings another case. Rabbi Chia Chazio Lahu Gavra, Chia saw this individual, Dahabakoi Bebeit HaKvarot, that was sitting in the cemetery. Amalei, he says to this individual, Lahav Ben Ish Ploni Kohenata, aren't you the son of so-and-so who is a Kohen? If you're son of a Kohen, then you're also a Kohen. So if you're a Kohen, what are you doing here sitting in the Beit HaKvarot in the cemetery? Amalei, in. He says, yes, I am a Kohen, and yes, my father was a Kohen, but Avua Dahau Gavro is speaking about himself in the third person, the father of that individual, meaning himself. Gavai Naim Hava, he went after his eyes, meaning that he was tempted by that which he saw. Natani Nav Bigusha, and he was attracted or got involved with a divorcee. Bechil alone. And I'm a child or I'm a product of that marriage, and that makes me into a Kohen Chalau. And a Kohen Chalau doesn't have any din of a Kohen. He doesn't have any of the restrictions of a Kohen. And therefore, I can sit in here in the Beit HaKvarot because I'm a Kohen Chalau, not a proper Kohen. Now, the Gemara brings this story over here, and it seems clearly like a non sequitur. It has nothing to do with the cases we brought before, and nothing to do with the cases that come afterwards. And that both perplexes Rashi and the Balei Tosafot. So Rashi over here says, Loit Freshlan, my boy Yehocha. We have no idea what this little story about Rabbi Chia is doing here. V'nira be'enai. And he says, in my eyes, this is what I believe the story is doing over here, which is that Rabbi Chia was a Talmid of Rabbi. He was a Talmid Muvak of Rabbi. And if he was in the presence of Rabbi, how did he give a psak halacha here, or how was he going after this individual, criticizing him for being in the Beit HaKvarot? But Rashi says is that's the difference. There is a distinction between psak halacha, which you may not do in the presence of your Rebbe or within three parsot of your Rebbe, but there's what's called a frushe meisura, to separate someone from doing isur, from engaging in isur. What the Gemara is indicating through the story, Rashi says, is even the face of your Rebbe, when it comes to those issues, you could be mafrish meisur, even if your Rebbe's there, even if your Rebbe's within three parsot. That's similar to a din that we have with regards to the Beit HaMerchatz. In certain places in the Beit HaMerchatz where people are undressed or not properly dressed, over there you're not allowed to give psak halacha, you're not allowed to engage in Torah. On the other hand, the Gemara there says that a fushe mitsura, to separate someone away from doing isur, that is permitted. And similarly over here, Rabbi Chia, in the face of his Rabbi, is being mafrish mitsur. He's trying to get this Kohen not to become Tameh. In the end, it turns out the facts make it that he doesn't need to, because he's not really a Kohen, he's a Kohen Chalal. But nevertheless, Rabbi Chia's intent was trying to stop this person from doing an isur, and that he has the permission to do, even in the presence of his Rebbe. That's the first way that Rashi explains it. Then afterwards, Rashi brings a Yerushalmi from Masechet Shvi'it. This is unusual because in general, Rashi does not quote the Yerushalmi. There are a couple of locations throughout Shas where Rashi does mention the Yerushalmi. In all likelihood, those cases where he does mention the Yerushalmi were probably additions later on into the Rashi, and not Rashi himself, because we do not find Rashi quoting the Yerushalmi, or using the Yerushalmi as a reference point for anything. But over here, the Rashi quotes the Yerushalmi, and the Balei Tosafot bring a similar Yerushalmi down, which is that the story was not about Rabbi Chia in the Yerushalmi, but rather about Rabbi. And these are two stories that took place in the same location. And there, the Gemara says that the location of these incidents in the time of Rabbi were in Akko. Now Akko, as we know from the Mishnah in Gittin, was the border between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz Laretz. And since Chamim were gozer on Chutz Laretz, Tumat, Eretz Ha'amim, that is the background to the cases over here. Rabbi went to Akko, and then he sees the individuals kneading their dough bitumah, meaning that they were kneading their dough in the sections of Akko, or the areas or suburbs of Akko that were classified as being outside of Eretz Yisrael, where there is Tumat Amim, and they were kneading the dough. He's going, what are you doing? There's too much Eretz Amim over here. Why are you kneading the dough, which is going to cause it to become tamei? Plus, you're going to have hafashat chala bitumah, which is problematic. And the second case was about the Kohen. The Kohen wasn't sitting necessarily in a Beit HaKvarot, in a cemetery, but rather in the area of Eretz Amim, which the Chamim were mitakein, or goes there, tumah on it. So how come you're in that section of Akko that is in Chutz Laretz? So therefore, you're right. The second case here has nothing to do with the first case, except for the fact that it happened at the same time with the same individuals. In both cases, instead of being Rabbi and Rabbi Chia, now the whole story is about Rabbi, and it's about his trip to Akko, where he notes that these individuals were engaged in activities that if you were an Eretz Ami, would make you Tamei. For a Kohen, you become Tamei. What are you doing out there? And for the dough, why are you making or kneading the dough? Bit Tum'ah, that's going to have a result and impact that the Chulin will be Tamei. Plus, you have inability to be mafrish the chala b'tahara. And that's the reason what seemingly is a non-sequitur story is brought over here, because both incidents happened together in a trip that Rabbi had to Akko. Now the Gemara says, pshita l'palga, haka amar d'mahani. It's clear from the stories that we saw before that partial smicha is permitted. Because by Rabbi gave him permission to be yoreh, gave him permission to be adin, but he did not give him permission to be matir b'chorot. So you see from that, that partial smicha is fine or is valid. Our question is, al tnai mai. If you have smicha on condition, is that considered to be a proper smicha? It says, tashma, damar le Rabbi Yochanan Rav Shemen, ariyata bishutenu. You are under our auspices, ad shitavo etzlenu, until you return to us. Where the Rashi learns it is that they granted him permission, they granted him smicha, as long as he was traveling or he was away from the local location. He said, once you return to us, your smicha will expire, you no longer be granted the right to adjudicate or permission to get psak with immunity, either because in the location they were in, there were greater talmid chachamim, they had sufficient dayanim, and so therefore we don't want you to have smicha on this location, and for some other reason that they believed it was important that he had it when he was on the road, but not when he came back. Rabbeinu Chananel learns the other way around, which says that your smicha will only come into effect when you're with us, or will only be valid when you're with us. If you're traveling away, then your smicha won't be valid. So either way that you explain it, you see from here that you can create a condition in the smicha. So that's the conclusion of the Gemara here, that you can have conditional smicha, or self-expiring smicha, or smicha that's only relevant in certain locations or certain places. You can put conditions on the smicha that's been conferred on these individuals. So Gufa, now the Gemara goes back to what we saw earlier on Daf Gimel Amud Aleph, that Shmuel said, Bet Danu, two people adjudicate a case, dinihem din. Then the outcome of that case, their conclusions are binding. El Shinekra, Beit Din Chatzuf. But they're called a Beit Din that is insolent, a Beit Din that is acting inappropriately. Nevertheless, their decisions are binding. As the Bali Tosfot pointed out over here, it's not only when it's two, even if it's one, it would be binding in this situation. All Shmuel is making the point is that you don't need three. And so whether you have two or you have one, all of those are binding dinim, just you call the Beit Din Chatzuf. Yotiv Rav Nachman, Makamadai Shmaitata, Rav Nachman was saying over this memra of Shmuel, Eitve Rova Rav Nachman, and Rova queried of Rav Nachman. So you have Rav Nachman, a Talmud of Shmuel, saying over this memra of Shmuel, and then Rav Nachman's Talmud Rova poses this question to him. In the case where we have a Mishnah for that, it says, Afilu Shnai Mizakin, Ushnai Mechaivin, even if you have two people that are exonerating or acquitting the individual, or two individuals that are finding the individual guilty, and one of the judges says, I just don't know. Then you have to add on extra judges. So there you have a situation in which you have three responses to the case at hand. If you are right, then just make it a case where you have two judges that judge the case. And that would be fine, because Bar Bishmol says it's a binding decision, just that you're considered to be a Beit Din Chotzu. So in our situation, when you started out with three judges, and one of them says, I don't know, you're still left with two judges that are coming to a conclusion. So why we're there, do we say that you have to actually add on judges to the case, is when he says any day until you get to a point where you have three individuals who can make a decision about the case. Why not just say that it's a din of Shmuel, and then it's a fine psak halacha? We'll just forget about the guy who says any yodea, and we'll consider it to be a beit din of two individuals. Mar says, shani hotam. Over there, by the bright, that's different. Mikara daita tzlata yative. They started the case with three judges, and they expected a psak from three judges. But one of the judges says any yodea and drops out. That's more problematic than in a case, hocha, lava daita tzlata yative, where they never started out with three judges. They started out with two judges, and the expectation is that the conclusion be drawn by those two judges. So in that case, it is a binding decision. It's just, you're classified as a Beit Din Chatzuf. Whereas in the case where you start out with three and then you end up with two because one of them says Eini Yodea, that disqualifies the Beit Din, and it's not considered as if you have two and then the other guy disappears. It's considered to be a case of three with one Eini Yodea, and that's why we have to add on Dayanim in that case in order to come to a conclusion with three Dayanim, and you can't invoke the principle of Shmuel. So Eitavei, so then they ask from a Tosefta on this position of Shmuel. From Shimon Gamliel Omer, Adin Bishlosha. When it comes to adjudicating cases, the proper number of judges is three. Upishara bishnaim. When it comes to arbitration, then two is sufficient. V'yofa koach pshara mikoach adin. And pshara has the upper hand when it comes to a din. Shnaim shedanu balei dinim yecholim lachzor ben. Because we have two individuals who adjudicated a case, two dayanim, that came to a conclusion in the case. The decision is not binding. And the litigants have a right to have them vacate the decision or undermine the decision. On the other hand, Shnaim Sha'asu Pshara, two individuals came to a arbitrated settlement or some sort of compromise between them, Ein Bali Dinim Yechulim Lachzor Bem. The litigants can't back out of that because they accepted the bargaining arbitration. Their acceptance of the binding arbitration is exactly that. It will be binding based on the decision of the judges, and they knew up front that there were going to be two judges here, or two individuals involved in the arbitration, and they accepted that, or that was the agreement between the parties, and therefore they're bound by the decision to accept that decision. Whereas by a case of a din, they're not accepting anything. They're going to the court, qua court, and therefore the court's got to be a qualified court and have three individuals in it. This seems to go against Shmuel's position. Here the Mayor Tosefta says that if you have two dayanim that come to a conclusion, their conclusion is not binding. Whereas Shmuel would say that it is a binding decision, just called a Beit Din Chatzuf. What are you going to say? That Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is a dat yachid and the Rabbanan disagree with him? Didn't Rabbi Abou already tell us that when it comes to two individuals who adjudicate a case instead of the three that are required, their decision in the case is considered to be invalid. Now, of course, Rabbi Abou is not going to be following a dat yachid or Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. He must be following the position of the Chachamim. And so you see from here that the Chachamim also agree that if you don't have three, it's disqualified from being a Beit Din, or the conclusions that they draw are not considered to be binding decisions. My answer is Gavra Gavra Karamit. You're asking a question from one person's opinion to another person's opinion. Shmuel has his position, and you're asking from Rabbi Abou has a diametrically opposed position, and you're saying, oh, from Rabbi Abou, we learn that it's not just the dat of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, but it's also the dat of the Chachamim. And what the Gemara answers is, that's right. That's according to Rabbi Abou. But Shmuel doesn't subscribe to Rabbi Abou, and Shmuel believes that the Chachamim do disagree with Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, and there he is aligning his position with that of the Chachamim. You have two, or even one, that gives a decision. They're called the Beit Din Chatzuf, but their decision is still binding. And so therefore this Tosefta is not a question to Shmuel, because he'll just say, I hold like the Chachamim. Now what you brought from Rabbi Abou is Rabbi Abou the Shittato, but Shmuel doesn't subscribe to that position of Rabbi Abou. And Tosfot points out over here that this end of the Gemara here is supportive of his conclusions and his arguments on Rashi, both before on Gimel Amud Aleph as well as on Hey Amud Aleph, where he says that the din of Rabbi Abou is applicable both to the one who holds Erev Parshiot as well as the one who does not hold the Erev Parshiot, number one. And number two is that even according to the one who believes in Erev Parshiot, he still subscribes to the din that we saw at the beginning of today's daf, that a yochid mumche, kheder rabim, can adjudicate a case, because otherwise we're going to have problems in Rabbi Bo's statement. Rabbi Bo's statement is, first of all, divrei akol. It wouldn't be divrei akol if it only applied to the one who didn't think of Erev Parshiot. Number two is, Rabbi Bo says divrei akol, and then we have a braita that clearly argues on it. So we have to have a way to reconcile Rabbi Bo's position with the position that we brought at the beginning of the Braita, that a yochid mumche d'rabim is qualified by saying that that's a din d'rabbanan. Even according to the one who requires three d'oraita, mid'rabbanan, that would be fine. And the one who holds einer parshiot kan, and therefore can't get the three dayanim from the words elukim that are mentioned here, he will get the source for his requirement of three dayanim from mishpat echad, the fact that you have a requirement for three dayanim. Although Tosfot does speculate over here and did mention back on Bet Amud Bet that there is a possibility that Shmuel and Rabbi Abou are only arguing within the position of the one who says Ikle Erev Parshiot. But Tosfot heavily favors the other views here, that Rabbi Abou's position is the Divrei HaKol, meaning both those that are subscribe to Erev Parshiyot and those that don't subscribe to Erev Parshiyot, as well as his ability to reconcile with the bright at the beginning of today's daf, where Rashi says that that's a din d'oraita. You can have one dayan, where Tosafot thinks it's a din d'rabbanan and it can be reconciled Rabbi Bahu over here. Okay, I'm going to stop here, three lines down, on the top of Vav Amud Aleph.